We're in 34 through 36, Jacob must move. And this is going to center around Jacob living in Shechem, of course. And how did he get to Shechem? Well, he left Laban. Just before he gets into the land, he sees two camps. The only mention of angels in Genesis, angels is plural in Genesis, so these two places, when he's getting ready to leave the land and he sees angels in Bethel, he sees angels as messengers. Here he sees angels as guardians. And he calls the place Mahanaim, and that name means two camps. This is an intersection between him leaving Laban, who's got a large camp with him, and Jacob, of course, who has a large camp with him, his family. What Laban and Jacob did, remember, they built a watchtower between you and me. They weren't parting as friends or parting as enemies. I'm going to watch to make sure you don't attack me, and I'm going to watch to make sure you don't attack me. And what Jacob sees is, in fact, there are angels guarding the land. Between Jacob leaving Laban and going into the land, where he's now going to meet who? Esau, who he thinks is an enemy. And God says, don't worry. There are angels as guardians over man, as well as man's messengers. So there's two visible camps and two invisible camps. But what Jacob does, he ends up living in Shechem after he meets Esau, and Esau invites him to come with him. He says, oh, sure, I'll follow in a few days. And he goes, just lies to him, when really he deceives Esau, when really he could have told the truth and it wouldn't have harmed him at all. He could have said, no, I'm going to stay in the land. I'm going to honor God by staying in the land. I'm not going to follow you down to where you live, down near Mount Seir. He's pathological. He lies when he doesn't have to lie. Well, that brings us to where we are today. Jacob must move. I started with Jacob coming back from Laban. And again, why did he have to go to Laban? Because he's running away from someone who wants vengeance on him. And now he's got to run again because he's afraid of vengeance being taken on him by another group because his sons have taken vengeance on them. So Jacob is still wrestling people. It's again with Hamor and his own sons. And this looks pretty innocent. Dinah went out to visit women of the land, and Shechem, the son of Hamor, and this is what it is in Hebrew. He saw her. That's the intensive verb at the beginning of the sentence. He saw her. He took her. He laid with her, and he humiliated her. Four verbs in the Hebrew text. So now it always translated like that in your English. English has various words for humiliation, but it's a defilement. Dinah must have been 15 or so at this time. He's old enough to marry. And we find in the narrative, Shechem is not a ruthless man. And he's a man who simply cannot control himself. He sees this young girl, he falls in love with her, and he wants to take her. And he takes her out of wedlock, which is a defilement on this young girl. But look at his heart. It says very clearly that his heart, meaning in Hebrew, that's his soul, is drawn, it's clinging to her. He doesn't want to let her go. And he loved her and spoke tenderly, or spoke to her heart, trying to win her over. So in Hebrew, it's literally his soul was clinging to her, and he loved her and he spoke to her heart, trying to win her over. Now, we don't know how she feels. Does she reject him or does she accept him? We don't know. When it comes up next, the boys find out, and here's what happens. Hamor hears what Shechem has done. He immediately goes to Jacob. Now, Jacob has heard what Shechem has done, but Jacob does nothing. But Hamor, the father of Shechem, goes immediately to Jacob and begins to speak to him, and he meets the boys on the way, and they find out what's happened. And as they're coming in from the fields, and Jacob does nothing while they're out in the fields, he's very passive. He doesn't do anything. He waits for the sons, and they come back. When they meet Hamor, they find out what happened, and they're furious. And they've done a disgraceful thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter, a thing that should not be done. Notice it doesn't say what he did was illegal. It says it shouldn't be done. It's against family culture, because a woman should not have relations with a man before marriage, nor vice versa. So he has defiled her. He's made her impure for anyone else. But he wants to marry her. And that's what they're trying to accomplish. So what they're trying to accomplish, it goes to, let's make a deal. Neither side is honorable in this deal. So keep that in mind as we go through. But Hamor comes and says, look, Jacob, you can settle among us. This land is open to you. Live in it, trade in it, acquire property in it. What he's done is he's let my son marry your daughter. And so Hamor comes in, he steps in, then Shechem, he throws his voice in as the son. And what he's saying is, you know, ask anything you want for this girl. Any dowry you want, we'll give as a gift. We'll pay whatever you ask. Just please, I want your daughter as my wife. Now, this is how a marriage would be brokered. The two fathers would get together and broker the marriage. The child has no say in the matter. In fact, they may do this when the child is still 2 or 3 years old. And, of course, the child would stay with the father until she was 15 or 16. But see, this is an abnormal situation because she's been defiled, and so Shechem is the one who defiled her, so he is the one who really is, in their mind, married to her. Well, that's not where the story ends. Jacob's sons jump in after this discussion between Hamor, Shechem, and Jacob. Jacob's son's going to say, Moses tells us their motive right up front. Deceit. They said to Shechem, we'll give our consent if you become like us by circumcising all your males. Now, you know what happens. Notice they're saying, become like us in this external rite. Notice what they don't offer. Covenant relationship. Externally, become like us. They've already got revenge in mind. That's why they tell them to circumcise themselves. They have no thought of, oh, we want you to be holy like us. We want you to be on God's side like we are. No, their whole goal in getting them to do the circumcision, because it's painful and it will weaken them. It's deceit. Now, other nations practice circumcision. Abraham's family are not the only ones, and Israel later on were not the only countries to practice circumcision. Circumcision was a rite of consecration or commitment. In Israel's case, it was not. What is circumcision? It's a sign. A sign of what? The covenant and the promises he made with Abraham, the covenant relationship, exactly. It's a sign of a covenant relationship. They say, become like us. This is an external thing. Become, wear this external mark like we have. They don't explain what it does, what it means, that it's a sign. They completely leave that out. They go back, and Hamor and Shechem present this plan to the fellow townsmen. All we have to do is circumcise ourselves, and this marriage will be brokered, and we'll be united with this family. We'll trade back daughters and sons, and we'll be able to intermarry, and all of their property will become ours. So let's consent, and they'll settle among us. This is where they will live. This is Jacob's intent. Jacob's intent is to stay here. And they see that, and they want that, so they do it. They have evil motives as well. The fact that this marriage was brokered, Dinah could have married Shechem. Really, nothing in here that says that would be wrong. That'd be an honorable solution to the problem. Dinah's not the key character, but everything centers around. She's the foil, if you will. She's the reason everything is taking place. But we don't know her motives, and we don't know what she's thinking. Why is she in Shechem's house? And why didn't she go home to her brothers and to Jacob? Why does she stay there? The deal is a deception. The deal is a deception. 3 days later, you know this, they're all in pain. Simeon and Levi go, they kill everybody. They kill Hamor and Shechem. End of the marriage. Well, it only takes two when you got guys that can't fight back. And Jacob did nothing. His lack of action is an encouragement to them to do this. This deception not only is murder, it's robbery. The sons of Jacob then, they come upon the dead bodies. They loot everything. They take everything. They take all the cattle. They take all the women. They take all the children. They take them back with them. Pure, unadulterated revenge. Compare that with the chapter before where you expected revenge and you got forgiveness. They had two ways to go. Revenge or forgive. But the forgiveness is, I'm going to forgive you in spite of what you've done. I may never get over it. The damage is so severe, but I'm going to forgive you. I'll never hold it against you. You find in the Bible, that's generally got to be a God thing. Because humans don't think like that. Now, the worst thing about this, we think, well, it's the defilement of Dinah, and it's the murder, and it's the theft. But you know, that's not the greatest sin in this passage. From God's perspective, that's not the greatest sin, because the covenant sign of God's promise was used to deceive and not to validate the grace and the love and the forgiveness of God. They took something precious to Abraham, sign of the circumcision, and defiled it. Shechem may have defiled Dinah, but what these brothers did defiled God himself. You know, you focus on the defilement of Dinah, and I stop short of calling it rape. NIV says violate, which I think is an okay word. It defiles her for marriage. But, you know, as I thought about this, you focus on that, and really, that's not the focus. The focus is defilement of the very sign of the covenant that God had given Abraham. And when you go back and read Genesis 17, that's when he changes Abraham's name. That's when he changes Sarah's name. That's when he promises you're going to have a son that's going to come through Sarah. It's not going to be Ishmael. So much important stuff happens there, and that's where he gives the sign of the covenant that's going to be make these people distinct and holy and make them representatives of God. How is this a representative of God? Esau represented God. These men don't. These men fall far short of representing God. Here's Jacob's response. Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, "You brought trouble on me.
Not God."
Not God. Yeah, exactly. See that? See how wrong they are? He didn't say to them, "You've defiled God's sign." No, you brought trouble on me. God says, "Get up, go to Bethel, settle there." You're not settling here, is the implication. "Build an altar there to God who appeared to you when you were fleeing from your brother Esau. It's about time for you to go back and keep your word to me that you made back there, because I have kept my word to you." These people around him could have come in and slaughtered this family without much effort. They were healthy. But look, here's what God does. Look at this. They set out and the terror of God fell on the towns all around when no one pursued them. Why did that happen? God almost cloaks them in a shield of terror. Before they set out, Jacob says to them, "Purify yourselves, get rid of the false gods, bury them." And they bury their idols, and that's when the Lord protects them. Their idols are buried, and they've set out. They're following what God told them to do. Now, this is the real return. This is Jacob returning where he's supposed to be. Jacob returned there. He gets there. God appears to him, and God blesses him. He says, "Your name is Jacob. Your name will be Israel." Now, he told him that at Peniel. So some of this is a summary of what God had already told him already. "I am God Almighty." That's El Shaddai. He called him that back at Bethel the first time. "Be fruitful and increase in number. A nation and a community of nations will come from you. Kings will come from your body." So this is beginning to show that a community of nations of these 12 tribes is coming. And there's the great iteration of the promise, "The land I gave to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, I give to you." The land I gave to Abraham and Isaac, I give to you. "I will give this land to your descendants, to your sons after you." Now this is about 30 years after he's been at Bethel the first time. He's coming back. Jacob sets up a stone pillar. He pours out a drink offering. He poured oil on it. Jacob called the place where God had talked with him Bethel, house of God, Bethel. Going on, God says, "I want you to settle there." Does he? Nope. He moves on. You know, God doesn't stop and say, "Stop. Don't go anywhere. I told you to settle here. Don't go anywhere else." He lets him go. The scariest thing about this narrative is that God never stops anybody from doing anything. The decisions they're making, they live with the consequences. The decision Jacob makes, which is no decision, he lives with the consequences. And he's going to have another consequence coming up. Because they move on. Rachel is dying as she has a son. She names him Benoni. That's the son of my sorrow, the son of my pain. But Jacob says, "No, that's not going to be his name. His name's going to be Ben-Yamin, the son of my blessing, the son of my right hand." That's where we get the name Benjamin. Ben-Yamin, not Benoni. Rachel died. She's buried on the way to Ephrath, which means fruit. But they're going to rename it Beit Lechem, house of bread. So the house of God is to the north of the house of bread. So he goes on and he's going to settle in a little town called Migdal Adar, and that's a little bit south of Bethlehem, a little bit over to the west, a little bit north of Hebron. And while they're living in that region, Reuben goes in and sleeps with Bilhah and defiles Bilhah, who is Jacob's concubine, and he defiles her, and Jacob and Israel, notice it says Israel, using his new name, hears about it and does nothing. That's his decision. Now that doesn't end his journey. After this happens, you know what he does? He goes home to dad. 35 tells us that Jacob came home to his father Isaac in Mamre, near Hebron, where Abraham and Isaac had lived, had stayed, had settled. Where he ends up. He comes home. Now, where'd God tell him to live?
Bethel.
Where does he go? Hebron. Back to daddy. While he's there, Isaac dies. He's 180 years old and he dies, probably 12 or 13 years after Jacob gets there. And when he died, Esau comes over from Seir, Mount Seir, where he's living, and they bury him together. And they bury him at Hebron. Where do they bury him? Abraham's cave, Abraham's tomb. So now you have Abraham and Sarah, Rebekah and Isaac, all buried there in that tomb. Final chapter is 36, and this is Toledot of Esau. Toledot means account. This is the account of Esau. That is Edom. That's how it starts. And so this chapter really is to kind of tie up the family of Esau. It tells us something about Esau. Esau took his wives, sons, daughters, and all the members of his household and everything. The point is that possessions were too great for them to remain. So Esau settled in the hill country of Seir. Now this reminds us of Lot. Lot and Abraham, wealth was so great they separated. Moses gives us some insight into Edom and Jacob being living apart because they were both wealthy. And he gives us some insight we don't really get until here. They both have very great possessions. They've both been greatly blessed by God. Lot and Ishmael and Esau all were outside of the line of promise. See, the line of promise is Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But related to those families are Lot, Ishmael, Esau, which is where the Edomites and the Amalekites. But they're all outside the line of promise. But they're not cut off from salvation. Because God promised Abraham that all nations will be blessed in you. So you don't just write these people off saying nobody from these nations can ever be saved, because that's not true. They're not in the line of promise, which leads to the Messiah, but they're all welcome to salvation. Now, both Edom and Israel, in history, as we go forward in history from here, they both achieve great material success, but neither achieve spiritual greatness. Why does God take Israel and Judah into captivity? Because they're spiritually strong? No, because they're so corrupt and so defiled. He says, I can't let you live in the land any longer. You don't want to say, oh, Jacob is wonderful and Esau was rotten. No, they're both sinful human beings. And yet they're both blessed with great material greatness. God's only bound one nation to his promise. That's Israel. He's bound himself to that people, Israel, by his promise to bring a Messiah from them. But everybody else, the Messiah can save. And these are the chiefs descended from Esau. Here you get some of the insight into the blessing and the strength of the Edomites. Make no mistake, the Edomites were evil people. But make no mistake, Jacob and his sons are evil people. But they have something that no one else has. They have the promise of Abraham, and they have the sign of Abraham. I will bless all nations through you, is what God promised to Abraham. And we are the recipients of that blessing, because none of us in this room that I know of are in the line of Jacob or in the line of Judah. But we're all related to Jesus Christ through faith, which is all based on the promise of Abraham. I will bless all nations through you. I love this picture because this really expresses the nature of Esau. When he greets Jacob, he grabs him and kisses him. No revenge. Holds nothing against him. And yet Jacob continues to lie to him. Next time, Joseph. This chapter kind of stands out by itself. Just look at these questions. See how is Joseph favored? Kind of think about that. And think about what are the results of the favoritism. And we'll look at some of that. Kind of some of the outcomes of that. We're way over time here. We got to go. Dear Father, we do thank you for your word.